Good day, and welcome to the Greylock Capital conference call about China with Michael Pettis. Today's conference is being recorded. This conference call with Michael Pettis is intended for general information purposes only. Mr. Pettis is not affiliated with Greylock Capital Management in any capacity. The views expressed by Mr. Pettis on this call are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Greylock Capital or any of its employees. The information provided on today's call should not be considered investment advice or a recommendation to purchase or sell any particular security. The content of this conference call is intended to be confidential among its participants and may not be published, copied, or disseminated without the proper written approval of Greylock Capital. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Hans Hume. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, after that wonderful legal disclaimer, I'd like to say that I've known Mike since I was in second grade in the American School of Tangiers, and he was in seventh grade. And he was my first day of work and my first job in New York. It turned out that Mike was there, and in short order, we figured out that we'd overlapped in Morocco. I guess Mike and I have had many, many discussions on many things going on in the world around emerging markets. We've often not seen eye to eye, so clearly some of the things that he may bring up and point out may not be things that I agree with. Could be that I don't agree with it because I don't have the same level of understanding or patience with looking at things in such detail. Mike has an amazing combination of experience in finance, firsthand experience, worked in the commercial banking side, transitioned more to the investment banking side, predicted and was part of the evolution of the asset class from a distressed loan swap market to a more traditional bond market. He was one of the early people who predicted the return of Latin America to the bond market, the issuance market. He then transitioned into academia. Right now he's one of the most illustrious professors at Peking University in Beijing. He also spends a lot of time writing books that actually people read, including The Volatility Machine. And in the last few years, I think he ended up becoming one of the foremost experts on China, utilizing a lot of the analysis and perspective that built up in the emerging markets and applying it to one of the big economic growth stories of the past decade. And with the perspective he has from the emerging markets, he's probably uniquely positioned to see some of the fault lines in a boom story like China and to some extent what opportunities, investment opportunities will come out of a, a restructuring in some sense of their economy. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
That is great timing. You switch it over to me just when you started coughing. I apologize. I've been in China for about 14 years, and I think the first thing that really struck me after a few years was that much of the myth that had developed around China was simply incorrect and largely based on the fact that very few Chinese or foreign economists that covered China seem to have any experience at all of developing countries. China is first and foremost a big developing country. There's nothing really that different about it. The 40 years of very rapid growth that China's experienced have been pretty spectacular, but even that's not unique. Argentina in the four decades before the First World War accomplished perhaps something even more impressive than China has, and it's sort of interesting that Argentina failed to live up to the expectations that were generated during that period, because China clearly will also fail to live up to those expectations. Since the Second World War, there have been something like at least 30 investment growth miracles, and by that I mean over a decade of over 7% growth. And they all function pretty much the same way, and unfortunately they all end pretty much the same way. In the early stages, you have this very rapid increase in investment that's funded by policies that force up the domestic savings rate, And it's really important to understand that the domestic savings rate in China is very high, not because the Chinese love to save money. That's a myth that I think we've managed to kill off after a while. China has the highest savings rate in the world, which is the same thing as saying it has the lowest consumption rate in the world. GDP is just consumption plus savings. Only because China has the lowest household income share of GDP in the world. In other words, the income share is very, very low, and that's why household consumption is very low. If you raise the household income share, you will raise consumption and you will reduce savings. And that's the key problem that China has today. In every single one of these cases, and China has been no exception, after a few years of very profitable investment, they reached a point at which the financial system was no longer able to invest in productive investments, by which I mean the value of the investment was greater than the cost of the investment. But rather than stop, it kept on going. And any of you who read one of my favorite economists, Albert Hirschman, will understand why. Hirschman spent a great deal of time in the 1960s and 70s trying to understand why. Why countries that have good policies, once those policies become self-defeating, why do they always wait too long to change? And Hirschman's argument, and I'm pretty sure it's not going to shock anybody, is that that period of growth, you tend to develop a very, very strong institutional support for that growth. And in China, that's referred to as the vested interests. And they oppose any change in the policies. And that's pretty much what we've been seeing in China. In 2007, then Premier Wen Jiabao acknowledged the deep imbalances and the addiction to debt and promised immediately to begin rebalancing the economy. But those of you who follow China will know that the imbalances got worse at an accelerating pace year after year for another 4 years. About a year after his speech, we first started to see this phrase in the Chinese press, vested interests, and I don't think that's a coincidence at all. Wen Jiabao discovered what Hirschman had been talking about. It's very hard to implement those reforms because of political opposition. If you look at the track record of these reforms, and Darren Acemoglu wrote a series of papers in the early part of the last decade that looked at the historical track record, and he came to two very bleak conclusions. The first was that very few countries are able successfully to manage these reforms without political and economic disruption. And secondly, the ones that do tend to fall on either end of the political spectrum, either they're democracies, and the classic case is the U.S. under FDR, or they're highly centralized autocracies, and the classic case there is probably China in the 1980s under Deng Xiaoping. So if you were going to advise, back in 2009, 2010, you were going to advise whoever the next president of China, you would probably advise that either that China has to rebalance, has to end its addiction to debt, otherwise it'll suffer the same fate that every other country that's followed this model has suffered, either a debt crisis like Brazil in 1982-83, or the U.S. in 1930-1933, or a long period of stagnation. The classic example is Japan after 1990, when it went from being something like 17% of the global economy to, I think today it's around 6 or 7% of the global economy. So you would advise him, in order to implement the reforms successfully, either you become a democracy, a credible democracy immediately, which I think we all agree is not very useful advice, or you centralize power and become the equivalent of Deng Xiaoping. And clearly that's what Xi Jinping has done. From the very beginning, the anti-corruption campaign was aimed at destroying alternative power bases. And to this day, there is an incredible fear within China. It's almost palpable. And he went about radically restructuring the army. In fact, last week he announced the most important and far-reaching of the various restructurings of the army. So once he has consolidated power enough to implement the reforms, and they know what the reforms are, if you read the reforms proposed during the third plenum in 2013, you'll see they're all more or less the correct reforms, none of which they've implemented. But once he's powerful enough to implement the reforms against the opposition of the so-called vested interests, then presumably he'll begin to do so. Now, someone like me can never tell you if he's reached that point until, you know, 6 months or a year after, it's obvious, because there's no way any foreigner and most Chinese will ever really understand the inner politics, as maybe 150 people who know. So all we can really do is watch for the shadow of that control. And I would argue this year is a crucial year. I would also argue that they recognize that it's a crucial year in the economic conference in December. They were pretty clear that the last 4 years of reform have been a complete waste of time. Officially, they're saying it was useful, but it's a time has come and must now be replaced with a new set of reforms. And conveniently, they call the old set demand-side reforms and the new set supply-side reforms. But if you read between the lines, it's clearly that this new set of reforms is in response to the tremendous frustration developed over the last 4 years by Xi and the people around him. So will it work? What do they need to do? The economists come out with the traditional reforms that they always come out with. You need to tinker here, tinker there, and increase productivity growth so you can grow your way out of debt. That sounds fine, except that debt itself is the constraint on growth. And there has never been a country in history that I can think of with a debt problem that no matter what reforms it implemented, was able to grow its way out of debt. In every single case, it never grew until there was explicit or implicit debt forgiveness. Explicit could be, you know, you default, you restructure your debt, and you get a haircut like in the Brady Bonds. Implicit could be like Germany in the early 20s, you simply inflate it away. But one way or the other, you've got to force the debt servicing costs onto somebody. And the only somebody in China, and I'll get into that if anyone's interested in the explanation, must be the state sector. So I'm sure there will be many questions, but the key reforms that the Xi administration must implement really boil down to two, without which there is no way they're going to recover. First, they have aggressively to pay down the debt, and the only way really to fund the paying down of the debt is by the liquidation of assets, SOE shares or land, but they won't liquidate land, because if prices go down, the banking system will get into trouble. So they'll have to privatize SOEs. But they won't privatize the big ones, the Beijing-controlled ones, because what they really want to do is undermine the power of the municipal and provincial elites. So we should start – we've already started seeing some moves in that direction in 2015, but nothing near enough. In 2016, we have to see real moves in that direction. By privatizing the SOEs, they will be able then to fund the only two things, in my opinion, that really matter. First, paying down of debt. And secondly, they can use the proceeds directly or indirectly to increase the GDP share of ordinary households. If you transfer wealth from the state sector to the household sector, and Beijing clearly understands they have to do this, that's the only way to get consumption to grow quickly. And it's key to get consumption to grow quickly, because if you want to get control of your debt, you have to stop this investment orgy, because that's what's generating the debt burden. But if you stop investing, unemployment soars. And the way to prevent unemployment from soaring is to find another non-leveraged source of demand. And there's only three sources of demand: investment, consumption, and the current account surplus. I think we'll all agree that China is much too big and the world is much too sick for the current account surplus to replace investment. There are productive investments available in China, but the kind of reforms to the financial sector, which people were very glibly talking about a few years ago, are something that have probably never been done in history quickly enough. I've asked all of these economists who said, all we have to do is reform the financial sector so it stops making bad loans and starts making good loans, and China will be fine. And I said, yes, and if I want to stop working, all I have to do is buy a lottery ticket. That's certainly the case. It's just very hard to do it. The only example I've seen of a sufficiently rapid change is probably Chile in the late 70s and 80s, and I can't find any other example. So that's probably not going to work. So all that leaves us is with consumption, which is why all this talk of rebalancing. We've got to keep consumption growing rapidly, and the only way to do that is to keep household income growing rapidly. And when you're closing down factories, et cetera, the only way to keep household income growing rapidly must be, and I can't figure out any exceptions, any alternatives, must be through wealth transfers from the state sector. So this is the big year to see that. And I'll leave it there and open it up to questions or comments.
Well, Michael, while we're waiting for questions, what are some of the questions you always get when you give these types of talks?
There are some, like how much time do they have for debt? And as you know, there's no science to that. There's no calculation that tells you. My instinct is maybe 3 to 4 more years of debt growing at this pace, but I don't know. And I think there are a number of people in Beijing who are much more optimistic. So we just have to watch the debt. The other questions I get, for example, are why not use the reserves to pay down the debt? Well, first of all, the amount of debt in China could easily be $20 trillion. That's bank debt. And total debt is $20 to $30 trillion. Reserves are approaching $3 trillion. And in the last banking crisis, something like 40% of loans went non-performing. So even if half or a quarter of that level, there simply aren't enough reserves. But more importantly, the PBOC is itself insolvent. And that may seem surprising, but remember that it borrows renminbi to buy dollars. And since June 2005, the renminbi has appreciated by 35%. So its liabilities have appreciated against its assets by 35%, and they probably are worth more than the assets. So if you take a dollar from the PBOC and use it to support a bank, and there's a huge technical problem about how you do that, I'll ignore that problem, you will reduce the net indebtedness of the banking system by a dollar, but you will increase the net indebtedness of the central bank by a dollar. So all you've really done is transferred the bad debt from the banks to the central bank. And since the banks are guaranteed by the central government anyway, nothing has really happened. Of course, I get tons of questions about the currency. What's their currency strategy and why are they so bad at communicating it? And at the IMF, I kept hearing that if only they could communicate well, we wouldn't have this problem. And I thought, wow, all the problems of the world are basically miscommunication. I don't think they have a strategy. In fact, I don't even think there's a they. So it's not a question of miscommunicating. There are lots of different constituencies that are fighting over what to do with the currency. And ultimately, whatever happens to the currency is likely to be the outcome of horse trading among the various constituencies, with Xi Jinping deciding whatever makes sense politically. They're terrified by the capital outflows. I can't tell you why I know that, but I know that. They're really worried about the capital outflows. And their questions always tend to be, which currency policy will stop the capital outflows? And I'm not sure there's a correct answer. There are really only 5 currency policies. You can appreciate the currency, which I don't think they're going to do. You can stabilize it at current levels, whether you define stabilizing against the dollar or against the basket. And that's what they're doing now in the hopes of rebuilding credibility so that money stops leaving. I don't think money is leaving because they're worried about the currency. I think that's just an additional reason to leave. I think money is leaving because there's a lot of nervousness, political and financial nervousness, in which case stabilizing the currency simply means subsidizing the outflows until you can no longer subsidize them. And because credibility is a function of the level of reserves, you really can't get credibility if your reserves are dropping 80 to 100 billion bucks a month. So I don't think that's going to work, and certainly so far it hasn't. They can let the currency depreciate 4, 5, 6% a year steadily. I don't see how that prevents outflows. That just creates a very clear price for not moving your money out. They're increasingly talking about a maxi deval and a peg. I think they could have done, and maxi deval is like 10%, 8%. I think they could have done that in July or before July. I don't think they can do that now. because I think they've lost so much credibility that that could very easily cause panicked outflows. And I may be wrong, but, you know, who wants to test me if I'm wrong? It's too risky. And then finally, there's some talk that they stop intervening altogether and let the currency find its level. That would make sense if currency flows or outflows were being driven by fundamentals, by perceptions of valuation. I don't think they are. I think this is flight capital, in which case the risk is that it doesn't find its level. It vastly overshoots, maybe goes down 30 to 40%. And that, I think, would be devastating for the economy. So I really don't think there is a working currency policy there. I would argue that if you want to stop the capital flows, you have to have a big positive shock to confidence. And the only thing I could think of would be a really aggressive debt deleveraging program, which politically I think would be hard to do. So I'm left with the only alternative, and that is to tighten capital controls. And I would say there's probably 3/4, 4/5 the chance that that's what they're going to do, because I don't think anything else works.
So all the people betting that there's going to be a 22% devaluation, think that is a likely scenario?
I'm not saying that it's unlikely. I'm just saying that I don't think it will stop the capital outflows. I think if they do, first of all, they don't want it to fall that. If they stop intervening, it could fall that much. And I think everybody would think that that was a disaster for the financial sector. But they clearly want to stop the capital outflows. And no one's really come up with a good plan involving the currency. And I think it's because there is no good plan.
You would say that something along the lines of what some Latin American countries did would work, some tax to bring your money back. What would be that capital control, the form of that capital control?
Well,
quote-unquote market-based or something more drastic?
The market-based system would be what we had before 2014, when the combination of higher domestic interest rates and appreciation expectations created that huge inflow, the speculative inflow, mostly run by SOEs. But they also don't want to raise interest rates because everyone is struggling with debt. A lot of the SOEs simply can't do anything except pay debt. And all the provincial bond swaps of last year, and there'll be more this year, were done. One of my students was in the CSRC, and he told me in 2014 the only question anybody asked, the only thing anybody cared about, was how do you reduce the debt burden for the provinces. That's what's generated all these provincial bond swaps. So raising interest rates is going to be really, really tough and will create outrage. So I don't think you really have market mechanisms. Maybe you could bring back appreciation expectations, but I think that's going to be tough. So it's going to have to be non-market. But it's really hard to prevent outflows in China. Because when you have huge trading borders, when you have corruption, when you have a long history of capital getting around the capital restrictions, we know historically that it's very, very tough to impose them. I was really shocked last week when I saw in the newspaper that I think it was Prudential. Their value dropped by several billion dollars when the Chinese government moved to stop a game that it never even occurred to me that you could do. But apparently you could sign up with foreign insurance companies, pay domestically with your credit card, and then at some point you could kill the policy and collect the dollars abroad. So you've got all of these schemes, the copper financing scheme, when oil prices in China were below global prices, it became a huge game. People would buy these enormous trucks, tanker trucks, fill them up with oil in China, drive to the Thai border, bribe the customs guy, and then sell the oil in Thailand. That's also capital flight. It's hard to prevent capital flight, but they can certainly reduce it. And one way is the old Chinese idiom, which I tell my wealthy clients, killing the chicken to scare the monkey. I suspect that in the next few months, one or two very famous, very wealthy individuals are going to be discovered taking money out of the country. And we'll go to jail in an attempt to scare everybody else.
Well, why don't we pause there and see if anyone on the line has a question for Michael.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star 1 to signal. And we'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue. And we'll go to Connie Teska with Plutius Management.
Yes. This is Mike. I have a question for you. Japan has long been accused of having unsustainable debt levels also. And I'll grant you it's not a emerging country. It's a developed country. But a lot of people have said that that's very sustainable because of the ownership of that debt. In other words, it's a huge debt level, but it's all owned domestically. Is there any, I mean, do you have any comment about that, and is there any parallel you can draw to what's happening in China to how Japan was able to manage it?
Sure. I mean, Japan's debt levels were surprising, but I would argue that there are broadly three things, not so much that explain it, but that were necessary for this to happen. First off, the Japanese government is extremely credible, and democracies do tend to be, functioning democracies do tend to be more credible. And that's really important because the moment there's any erosion of credibility, you would end up seeing bank runs, et cetera. So the question is, can the Chinese government maintain the same level of credibility that the Japanese government can? We've seen bank runs in the past after 1997. We'll see. Right now, credibility in Beijing is quite high. The second thing is, and this we know, if you graph debt to GDP on one axis and debt per capita on the other, you'll notice, and I'm sure none of you will be surprised, particularly developing country guys, that the poorer you are, the lower the debt to GDP you seem to be able to carry. It's a pretty straight line. And I don't think that's an accident. I think, you know, if someone were to tell you that all American businesses can carry the same debt load, you would probably think that's absurd. A water utility servicing New York can certainly carry far more debt than an internet startup in California. These things matter, and one of the things that matters to a great extent is the ability to protect creditors under the rule of law and the volatility of the underlying economy. And I would argue that Japan is less volatile than China, and I wouldn't say it publicly, but I suspect that the legal system is more trusted in Japan than it is in China. The third condition, and this is a really important one, and this is why when Abenomics was announced, my immediate reaction was that it can't possibly work. The third condition is that you've got to keep interest rates at zero because, you know, I can carry $1 billion worth of debt if the interest rate is zero and if you don't ask me to pay principal, you know. But how do you keep interest rates at zero? Well, nominal growth has to be zero. That's really important. Assume you get Abenomics is successful, you get 2% real growth, 2% inflation, nominal GDP growth is 4%. What do you do to interest rates? If you raise them to 4, which is more or less where they would have to be in that case, suddenly the fiscal deficit, assuming a primary balance, and they have a primary deficit, but assuming a primary balance, the fiscal deficit is suddenly 10% of GDP. Not immediately because of the debt, some of the debt is has longer duration, but it very quickly moves towards 10% of GDP. And that means that it has to constantly be refinanced. And by the way, interest rates have the additional feature of accelerating principal payments. So suddenly you have a real cash flow problem. So you say, fine, we won't do that. We'll keep interest rates at zero. But if you keep interest rates at zero, you're basically confiscating wealth from savers, who are the household sector, and subsidizing users of capital. So you're unbalancing Japan. And they all say, and they're right, that they need to strengthen consumption. But how do you strengthen consumption when you've got this huge hidden tax on household income? This negative return on their deposits. So I don't think it can work. China could probably bear more debt than we think as long as interest rates are, as long as GDP growth is not much above zero. And in fact, that's my my most likely scenario. I don't think China is going to collapse because I think they're very credible. The government is still very credible. What I expect is more of a Japanese-style long decade or two of much, much lower than expected growth.
Okay, thank you.
And once again, it is star one to signal for a question or comment at this time, star one. And we have no other questions at this time.
Well, if there are no further questions, then, Michael, why don't we invite you to do a short wrap-up, and we'll wish everyone a nice weekend.
Let's assume China doesn't have a collapse and a disruptive adjustment, which is, I think, it's not impossible, but it's the less likely scenario, and we get what I would call the long landing, where growth rates slow year after year after year, and Beijing pretends that it doesn't. What's the outlook? Well, a lot of people say that if growth is slow, the Chinese will be up in arms, and that's not true. The Japanese weren't, and the reason is, if you look at rebalancing means going from a period in which household income grew slower than GDP into a period in which it grows faster than GDP. So GDP growth can collapse, but household income growth shouldn't if the policies are done correctly. So what are the implications of that kind of rebalancing for the world? Well, first off, it won't be a disaster for the world any more than Japan's rebalancing was a disaster for the world. In fact, if they rebalance correctly, their current account surplus will contract as a share of global GDP. And since the world lacks demand, that contraction will actually add net demand. So it'll be marginally good for the world, but it won't be evenly spread. Metal producers who have already been killed, I think metal prices still go down a bit more. I don't really see... I mean, it's hard for me to predict energy prices because there's too much politics in there, but I don't really see much demand coming out of China. But if you're a manufacturer, if you're a Mexico, for example, you'll do well out of Chinese rebalancing, and they already are. And even the U.S. will do well out of a Chinese rebalancing. So much slower growth in China is not a problem for the world. What we are going to see, unfortunately, I think, is a lot of bond defaults, both at the sovereign and at the corporate level. I think that's almost inevitable. I really don't see any way around that, not just in China, but in Latin America and a number of other places, Asia, et cetera. So I think that's one thing that we should be very aware of, that credit is going to become a problem as growth slows. But overall, the Chinese rebalancing, even at much lower growth levels, does not need to be bad for the world and shouldn't be any more than Japan's was. The exception is if we have a collapse. That would be pretty negative. But so far, I don't think that's likely.
All right. Well, that's a very nice for people who like bond defaults.
Well, you know, if you like bond defaults, you can also move to Europe.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you again for joining us. And thank you for everyone on the line, and enjoy your weekend.
Bye-bye.
That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.